This is Gulf Coast State College Anatomy and Physiology, the Spinal Cord and Spinal Nerves, Part 1. First, a little bit of review here, the spinal cord and the spinal nerves. Let's break that down. The spinal cord and the brain, remember, they form the central nervous system. The spinal nerves, in other words, all these yellow wires dangling off the cord, are part of the peripheral nervous system. So you remember that from last unit. This is the overview slide. Again, I'd like to start with the overview of the functions, then we'll break it down in detail later. What's the function? Two major functions of the spinal cord and the spinal nerves. Number one, it's a highway for upward travel of sensory information toward the brain and downward travel of motor information towards the place where we're going to get some kind of effect that some genius called the effector tissues. So what do I write down here off to the side? Because I always like to have the big picture in mind when I'm studying as a student. I write down off to the side here, information superhighway. That's what it is. Sensory information up to the melon, motor information carried down away from the brain. What about function number two? Well, the spinal cord is not just a doormat. I mean, it can do a little bit more than that. So it can do a little bit of thinking. Remember our term integration? Sounds like interpretation. Yeah, the spinal cord can do a little bit of thinking. It can sum up all the inhibitory and all the excitatory nerve signals it receives and make a kind of a decision with it. It's kind of a small decision. And it's involved in something we'll study called spinal reflexes. So those are the two major functions. Let's go ahead and break down the anatomy first of the spinal cord. The spinal cord, here it is on a gross anatomy picture. I love these gross anatomy pictures. Here's a bony vertebrae from AMP1, and there is our nice, delicate spinal cord tissue. And we got to protect the spinal cord. One of the worst things I hated to see when I was going through training were the spinal cord injuries. I can still remember some of those patients in my mind, especially the motorcycle accident victims, for example. So we got to protect the spinal cord. Three ways to protect the spinal cord, if you should ever be asked. Number one, of course, we got that bony vertebral column we just talked about. Number two, we have these coverings called the meninges, and we'll break those down in detail shortly. And last but not least, a nice cushiony layer of water called cerebrospinal fluid. Just like they have those water barriers on the highway to prevent you from kind of running into the cement. So water or cerebrospinal fluid forms a nice cushion for the cord and also, we'll see later, for the brain. Let's break down the meninges. Hopefully you're seeing these in the brain lab about now at the same time. The meninges are the connective tissue coverings around the cord and around the brain. Off to your left is a nice color-coded picture that I decided to use. In sort of a lime green color, we have the outermost layer that you will call the dura mater. It is the tough outer layer. If you like your Greek root words, dura means tough and mater means mother, and it is a tough mother, so to speak. If you try to cut it in the lab on that sheep brain or try to tear it, you'll see how tough it is, and that's how it got its name. The middle layer, shown here in sort of a light purple color, is the arachnoid mater. Arach means spider web or spider. Oid, root word, means like. like freakoid means like a freak. So the arachnoid mater is a spider webby layer. And you'll notice when you remove the dura mater off the brain in the lab, the arachnoid mater is kind of webby and stringy, and it will just shred and actually disappear. Just like if you ever stuck your finger into a spider web at home, what happens when you take your finger away? Well, it's gone. So it's really hard to see it in lab after you do your dissection. Then the innermost, the deepest layer, shown here in red, is the pia mater. The pia mater, if you like your root words, pia means thin, and it's a thin, delicate layer. The pia mater is plastered right on the cord and right on the brain like a layer of thin cellophane, like shrink wrap almost. And one important note here is in the pia mater, notice lots of blood vessels. And always remember this in your clinical careers or whatever, where there are blood vessels during trauma or during surgery, there can be bleeding. And I show a video in my face-to-face course of brain surgery, and when they get to the pia, they're very careful to make sure they have good hemostasis when they're in the area of the pial blood vessels, because certainly you don't want to have a hematoma on the brain or on the cord during surgery. Here's a special extension of the pia mater I want to talk about, called denticulate ligaments. Look at your root word, dens. Dens, like dentist or dental, means a tooth. And these ligaments got their name because they're shaped like a tooth, or more like a triangle. Off to your upper left, I used a color-coded one, and shown here sort of in a, I guess, a greenish-bluish color is a denticulate ligament. Then down below is the real deal in the gross anatomy specimen. Here is, on one side, shown one of the denticulate ligaments. They are triangular extensions of the pia mater that suspend the spinal cord in the middle of its dural sheath. In English, these extensions of pia mater extend out to the dura. And one way to think about them is they're kind of like, well, maybe struts on a car, or like suspensory ligaments. And they protect us. How? Well, they protect us from something called acceleration and deceleration injuries. In other words, if you're in your car seat, or maybe on a ride at the amusement park, you're kind of going up and down, right? Well, you don't want the spinal cord getting shaken hard up and down and banging around in there and getting bruised. So these suspensory ligaments, so to speak, they keep it in position and protect us. But they can only do so much. I'm going to give you an example. One of the worst things I've ever seen. It was not here in Florida, but I was working in the emergency room. And in came a patient who was riding a jet ski. He set up a ramp on a lake. He went up the ramp, came down on his jet ski on the water hard, with his back perfectly straight. And he came down so hard that when his back came down on that seat, that deceleration injury, that sudden stopping on the car seat, well, the spinal cord went down and unfortunately overwhelmed his denticulate ligaments. It sheared the ligaments and the cord went down all the way far inferiorly as it sheared the ligaments. Unfortunately, some blood vessels also run in those ligaments, so he sheared the blood supply to the spinal cord, and he was completely paralyzed. So that's an example where, unfortunately, the denticulate ligaments, they got overwhelmed. I mean, they could only do so much. okay, we learned the three different meninges. By the way, I forgot to give you a mnemonic. A lot of people learn those layers by a mnemonic because they spell a word from the deepest to the most superficial or outermost. They spell P-A-D. In other words, what pads the spinal cord, what pads the brain, pia, arachnoid, and dora. So that's a little mnemonic that'll help you remember those coverings. And then we have to know some spaces that are sort of in between those coverings, and they are important spaces. Our first space we'll learn is the epidural space. Look at your root words. Epi means on, right? So on top of the dura or surrounding the dura, there's a space. It's called the epidural space. Yes, it is between the dura mater and the bony wall of the vertebral cavity. I drew a little red arrow on your PowerPoint to show it nicely. And that space, you should know, is filled with fat. Why do I want you to know that? Well, you probably heard of epidural anesthesia, and they try to get the anesthetic in the epidural space. And they do it knowing the anatomy, including knowing that that space is filled with fat. So kind of by feel, you learn that sensation of that space and you know where to squirt the numbing medicine. Our next space, called the subdural space, and you guessed it by the root words, it's under the dura. Therefore, it would have to be between the dura mater and the arachnoid mater. And here it is shown on your color-coded drawing that I thought showed it most nicely. Last but not least, my favorite space by far is the subarachnoid space. So it's beneath the arachnoid, which would place it, of course, between the arachnoid mater and the pia mater. And you have to know what's in this gorgeous space, our wonderful, beautiful fluid called cerebrospinal fluid, typically abbreviated CSF. Sometimes during the course, I'll call it brain water or spinal fluid, but it's the same stuff. It's technically cerebrospinal fluid. Why is this space and that fluid so important? Well, probably all of you or a lot of you heard of something called a spinal tap. It's also called a lumbar puncture. You may have seen it done. You may have had one done. I saw one done on my little baby when he was just a young one, and it was hard to watch. I had to leave the room, actually. I didn't mind doing them when I went through training, but I sure didn't like to see it done on my little baby. But why is it done? What's the purpose? Three major purposes. First, to measure the pressure of the cerebrospinal fluid. That's the first thing that they do when they do a spinal tap. You measure the pressure. Why? Because some people have what you may have heard of in layman's terms called water on the brain. Well, it's really not water on the brain. Technically, it's hydrocephalus. That means the pressure is so high that it can actually crush our nervous tissue. Yeah, you can crush brain tissue from within if the CSF pressure is too high. After you measure the pressure, then you can start to draw out some of the fluid. Why would you sample brain water or spinal fluid? You sample it to diagnose a couple of things, and I want you to write them down off to the side here. Number one, you look for infection. You may have heard of meningitis, and you got to sample the CSF to be able to check for different kinds of meningitis. Also, sometimes you check for cancer cells. You can detect cancer cells in the CSF. Third purpose, well, if someone has a meningitis, or a brain abscess or a brain cancer. As we mentioned in the last unit, it's sometimes very difficult to get your drugs to the brain tissue. And sometimes you have to jack the antibiotic or the chemotherapy directly in the CSF in order to get your medication to the infection or to the cancer. Let's talk about how to do a spinal tap. Now, don't ever do anything I say to do during these talks. Learn the material, but don't actually do this stuff. So what's the technique? And I want you to know the technique briefly. We're going to take a big needle, and we're going to insert that long needle into the space where the CSF is. So, of course, we have to insert the needle into the subarachnoid space. Generally safe to stick that needle in the spaces between lumbar vertebrae 3 and lumbar vertebrae 5, because for those of you who looked ahead, which I hope is all of you, you know that in an adult, the spinal cord ends at lumbar vertebrae number 2. So it's considered poor form to stab the spinal cord because you might paralyze somebody. So you want to stick the needle in the subarachnoid space below or inferior to the spinal cord, because the meninges do extend beyond the spinal cord inferiorly. So how's it typically done? And maybe some of you have seen this. Well, you have the patient lay down on the table. You draw a line on their back right across the iliac crests that you learned in AMP1. And it just so turns out that that line, if you draw that line across there, it almost always ends up coming across the spinous process of lumbar vertebrae number 4. That's why we teach you this basic anatomy. And then, if you've ever seen this done, you have the patient curl up on their side in the fetal position. Why? Well, because that opens up the spaces between the spinous processes. Then you numb the skin. Once you numb the skin with a little bit of lidocaine, actually, that should pretty much take care of any discomfort for the patient. Then you get your big long needle. Now, don't show it to the patient. Don't go, okay, Mr. Jones, now we're doing the spinal tap, and here's the needle, because if they ever see that needle, they're going to freak out and try to jump off the table. So don't show them the needle. You take that big long needle, and you very carefully insert it in between the space. Right here is a great space to choose. You already numbed the skin, and as long as you don't scrape the bone, don't scrape the bone. That hurts. You can insert that needle in there, and knowing the anatomy, you slowly advance the needle through the epidural space where you feel a little kind of mushiness. Then you hit the dura. And remember, the dura is tough, and you will feel a little pop. You'll feel that vibration of the pop through the needle and through the syringe you're holding. You advance it just a smidgen more, and then some clear straw color fluid will come out, and you know you're in the right spot. That's the spinal fluid, and you can start to do your testing, measure the pressure, and then do your sampling. So that's how to do it. Again, don't do it at home. This is just how to do it, okay? One girl, I'll never forget it, she called me at home. First of all, poor form, don't call your professor at home. And she said, now, how do you do that again? And I'm like, you're not really doing this at home, are you? Anyway, don't do it, just know about how to do it. This is a beautiful gross anatomy shot. I love these gross anatomy shots of cadavers. This one here is just to kind of look at and marvel at. This is someone just really cut open that basically took the back half off, and you can see where they cut the bony vertebrae, and then here comes the spinal cord itself. And we're going to take a look at that and break it down and learn some basic terminology. So a lot of terminology coming at you now. And the picture in your book is kind of weak, if I may say so. Here's the spinal cord with the spinal nerves dangling off of it, but we're just going to have to work with it. Couple things. Yeah, you do have to know the numbers. I'm not big on numbers, but I'll tell you the numbers I want you to know from my course. It is about 16 to 18 inches long, and I want you to stop right there and maybe take a look at a ruler. Because if you were like me before you took this course, I bet you thought it was a lot longer than that. I mean, I thought it went from like, you know, the bottom of my head all the way to my tailbone, but it's much shorter than you think. And only about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. So, you know, about the size of maybe around as your thumb. So we got to protect that thing. It's smaller and more delicate than you think. The shape, you may have seen it in lab by now. It's like a squashed oval or a flattened cylinder. It starts, by definition, the spinal cord begins as a continuation of a part of the brainstem we'll study called the medulla oblongata. You must know that. All my friends on the weekend when we're out, we just call it the medulla for short. So if you want to be in my group, just call it the medulla. In an adult, you must know, as we talked, it ends at lumbar vertebrae number 2. But in a newborn, it ends at lumbar vertebrae number 4. Again, if you're dealing with little kitties, you gotta know the differences. Why does that happen? Why is it different? Well, I usually draw this on the board, but now you're going to have to use your imagination. Let's draw a spinal cord and maybe draw it on a piece of paper. And you draw it right there as the ending of it. And you say we have a little baby here. And then it's right across from lumbar vertebrae number 4. The growth of the spinal cord stops at about age 5. But the bony vertebrae, well, picture them. They just keep on marching downwards. So in an adult, even though the spinal cord stopped growing at age 5, those bony vertebrae kept growing and elongating and marching downwards, and that's why it ends up lining up with lumbar vertebrae number 2 in an adult. More basic terminology. There is a swollen, enlarged area of the cord up in the neck region called the cervical enlargement. There's another sort of a swollen area of the cord down lower called the lumbar enlargement. So the spinal cord is really not a perfectly straight kind of a cylinder. It has these swollen areas. Why? I mean, you could remember this easy, but why should it make sense, and how can you remember it longer? Well, the cervical enlargement has the nervous tissue to supply your upper limbs. And think how much more, you know, motory and sensory stuff, you know, how much more meat and nerve tissue it takes to operate your upper limbs than it does, say, to operate a little area of skin and muscle on your chest wall right here. Likewise, with the lower limbs, you know, if we move them around or shake them around or whatever, again, think how much more complicated that is, how much more meat, how much more nervous tissue it takes to operate the motor and sensory functions of your entire lower limbs, maybe, again, just compared to a little pinch of skin here in the thorax. So that's why there's more meat and a little bit of a swelling in those areas. Couple more definitions. The conus medullaris is the cone-shaped end of the spinal cord. Plain and simple. If I ask you what is the end of the spinal cord, you say the conus medullaris and nothing else off that multiple choice list. Then comes the phylum terminale. I like that name. Terminal means end. Phylum means like a filament or a thread, and it is a thread-like extension of pia mater that goes all the way down and anchors the spinal cord to the tip of our tailbone that you will really call the coccyx. So the phylum terminale is a thread of piamotor that goes from the cone to the coccyx. Why? Again, it has a purpose. The design matches the mission. It's for protection again. It's like a tether. It's so that the spinal cord doesn't kind of wag around like a tail and slap against the bony column and get bruised. Again, more definitions on this slide. We always have to learn the definitions as part of anatomy. If you look at the spinal cord, we're going to look at the wires, the yellow wires coming out. Most of those wires that we call spinal nerves sort of come straight out like a straight shot. I usually use my body as an example, and I stand straight up and I just stick my arms straight out, and that represents a pair of spinal nerves shooting out the spinal cord. However, as you get lower off the spinal cord, the lowest roots of spinal nerves sort of dangle down, and someone looked at it and said, "Ooh, that looks like kind of a horse's tail." And it does. So they call that the horse's tail. The technical name is cauda equina. Equine means horse, like equestrian sports in the Olympics or with the horses, and cauda means tail. So if I give you a multiple choice and say, what is the name given to the appearance of the roots of the lowest spinal nerves dangling off the cord, and I put, you know, mouse's tail, pig's tail, horse's tail, you pick horse's tail. Of course, the question is going to be harder than that. Last but not least, we have to define something called a spinal segment. Somebody just made this up. It's an artificial kind of a thing. You can't really see it. You can't look at a cord and see a spinal segment with like dashed lines or dotted lines or anything like that. It is, by definition, an area of the spinal cord from which a pair of spinal nerves arises. My visual is this. I stand up. I stick my arms out straight to the sides, and then I slice me up with a knife like a loaf of bread. And then I slice my body above my arms, and I slice my body below my arms, and then I take that wedge of body out. That wedge of spinal cord, like a piece of a loaf of bread, with its attached pair of spinal nerves, is called a spinal segment. Here's a picture from your book. I hope you can match that with the visual I just gave you. So here is a spinal segment by definition. A slice, like a slice of bread, of the spinal cord with one pair of attached spinal nerves. Now we get to break it down and get to some of the good stuff that maybe you already saw in histology in the lab, or you will soon. Let's look at the internal anatomy of the spinal cord. I want to start with what's called the gray matter. So here's your spinal cord in a cross section. Looks like a squash cylinder. You got this light stuff on the outside, then you get this dark stuff on the inside, which just is stained brown in this tissue section. The gray matter is this area here, which is dark. It's shaped like the letter H, or like a butterfly. I like a butterfly. That's just my favorite example. Gray matter is gray. In real life, if you have a fresh tissue section of the brain or of the spinal cord, it does look darker. Why does gray matter look gray? You should remember this. It is darker because it contains neuron cell bodies. And those nerve cell bodies are clustered together in like little groups, like little lumps, like little jelly beans or nuggets. And they have a common mission. And a group of nerve cell bodies that has a common mission is called, or they're called, nuclei. Again, that's different than what you learned in A&P 1. a nucleus was a nucleus of a cell. Well, now nuclei means a group of nerve cell bodies that has a common purpose. And why are they dark? Remember what is stuffed inside of nerve cell bodies that make them look dark. A lot of rough ER makes them look dark. What's the purpose? What's the function of the butterfly? It's integration, processing. I like to think of it like a little butterfly, and the little butterfly has a little brain so it could do a little bit of thinking. Not a lot, but a little bit. Somebody who first saw this thought that it looked more like horns, I guess like antlers on a deer. And so I guess they thought this look, I guess it would be like a 6-point buck. Here's some horns here, and here's some horns back here. And then two little horns just starting to bud, little baby antlers just budding there. So I guess it'd be like a 6-point buck. But in any case, the real terminology is this. We have a pair of horns in the back called the posterior horns. We got these little baby horns on the side called the lateral horns, and then the big horns in the front called the anterior gray horns. Why? Because they're in the front, so they call them anterior. Gray, because it's gray matter, and horns, because it looks like a horn to somebody. So what's the function? This is what they probably don't teach you in lab. What is the purpose of the nerve cell bodies clustered together in the posterior gray horns? If I ask you, you will say sensory. What about the lateral gray horns? If I ask you the function of the nerve cell bodies in that location, you will say autonomic nervous system motor function. Which means what? And this should roll off the tip of your tongue. It means those cells help supply motor function to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Write it down right now off to the margin if that's not already sticking in your brain. And then finally, the anterior gray horns, they have nerve cell bodies that supply somatic motor function. In other words, they operate your skeletal muscles. Then we have another little piece of the butterfly, this little piece going across. Some people think of that like the crossbar of the H. I think of it like the body of the butterfly. And that dark piece of gray tissue going across is called the gray commissure. Gray because it's gray matter. And commissure, doesn't it sound like the word communicate? And I like that comparison because the gray commissure is a piece of tissue that's going to let the left wing of the butterfly talk to the right wing of the butterfly. It allows what we call lateral transmission so the two sides can sort of talk to each other if they need to. Let's take a minute here for a clinical break, and I'll give you some examples of test questions. Because you're thinking, okay, you know, that's not that hard. I can remember the three horns and the three functions. But how does he ask it on the test? Well, I ask you to kind of take a little bit further, a little mini critical thinking. And here it goes. Your patient has an ice pick injury, and the ice pick goes through a posterior gray horn. What problem will your patient have? Feeling their foot, beating their heart, or moving their arm? If you think about it for a second and know the function, you know the answer has to be feeling their foot. Another example. Your patient has a gunshot wound. The bullet is lodged in a lateral gray horn. What problem will your patient have? Feeling their foot, beating their heart, or moving their legs? And the correct answer is beating their heart, because these horns are where the ANS motor function is. Final example. Your patient has polio or Lou Gehrig's disease, also called ALS, which does affect primarily the nerve cell bodies in the anterior gray horns. What problem will your patient mostly have, at least to begin with? Feeling their arms, beating their heart, or moving their legs. And the best choice of their, of course, there would be moving their legs. So a great slide. Great to know the functions of these tissues you're learning in lab. Also in lab, you saw this tiny little tunnel running right through the middle of the spinal cord. So what did some genius call the canal that runs through the center of the cord? They called it the central canal. Look, guys, it ain't rocket science or I wouldn't do it. We will learn later on that this is continuous with or connects with one of the chambers of water in the brain called the fourth ventricle. And what you need to know now, of course, is the fluid that runs through the central canal is our old friend, cerebrospinal fluid. Let's go ahead now and break down the white matter inside the spinal cord. Notice in this histological preparation, all this white stuff. This is white matter. Remember, white matter is white because it's usually white myelinated axons, and the myelin makes it look white. And also notice that in the spinal cord, the white matter surrounds the gray matter. It wraps around the butterfly. I picture myself standing up, and I picture myself as the butterfly, as the gray matter, and I have a little brain because I'm a little butterfly, and then I surround myself with thousands upon thousands of vertically oriented white electrical cables running up and down me and surrounding me. Remember, that's the information superhighway surrounding the butterfly. How do you know the front of the cord from the back of the cord? This is really important when you're naming the parts and pieces in the lab especially. The spinal cord has these partial thickness grooves that dive into it. There's a big one in the front called the anterior median fissure. I remember this because in anatomy, the fissure, a fissure, is a deep, wide groove usually. So I just remember the fissure's fat and in the front, and that's just the way my pea brain remembers it. And in the back, we have a small slit. And in anatomy, a slit is a sulcus. So this slit in the back we call the posterior median sulcus. Let's break down the root words there just for a little bit of review and make it easy for you. Posterior means it's in the back. Median means it's in the middle. And sulcus means it's a slit. So it's the back, middle, slit. So that's how you get oriented on the spinal cord, and that's really important in your lab studies. So the white matter, just like the gray matter, it's not arranged there willy-nilly. It's not like someone just, you know, took a bunch of axons and just splattered them in there willy-nilly. They're organized just like the gray matter was organized. They're organized into general areas, three general areas to start. And in the front, these large collections of axons are called the anterior because they're in the front. White, because it's white matter. Columns, because they're arranged, well, sort of in big columns, kind of like big telephone poles full of wires. off to the side, we have another general grouping of axons called the lateral white columns. And then finally in the back, another general grouping of white matter called posterior white columns. Again, because they're in the back and they're white and they're columns of cables running up and down your cord. Now, they're even organized better than that into sort of little subdivisions, if you will. Again, it's not like someone just took those axons and splattered them willy-nilly. They are in small groups that have a common purpose. And this is a big picture, general item you must know for the central nervous system. When we have collections of axons in functional bundles, groups that have a common mission, they are called tracks with a star. So you know you gotta know that one. Let's take a look at them. Let's take a look at the tracks and the function and the naming of tracks. These are what we were referring to earlier as the information superhighway. Remember, sensory and motor information going up and down the sides of your cord surrounding your butterfly. The sensory tracks have the upward or ascending information, and the motor tracks had the descending information. How do we name tracks? It's easier than you think. The track name usually tells you something about the location and or the direction of the signal. I'll give you an example. At first it might seem a little overwhelming, but let's break it down. There's a track we'll look at called the lateral spinothalamic tract. Well, first, we have the word lateral. So guess where it's located on the spinal cord? Anterior, lateral, or posterior? You guessed it. It's in the lateral part of the spinal cord. What about the rest of this word? Well, anytime you see on a tract the word spino, you think spinal cord. And you can't get any lower than that. I mean, the spinal cord is the bottom part of the central nervous system. Then we have another word here called thalamic. Well, that's a part of the brain that we haven't even learned yet. Well, who cares? It's got to be somewhere above the cord, so it's higher than the spinal cord. So which way are impulses traveling if they're going from the spinal cord to some other part of the brain that you don't even know yet? Well, they have to be going upwards. So let's take it a step further. If I had asked you to guess what kind of signal this was, sensory or motor, I hope you would say sensory because it's upward or ascending information. So that's how you break it down. Let's take a look in a little more detail. This is a picture, a drawing of a spinal segment. It's showing in red some motor tracks, and I like that your book uses red throughout for motor stuff. It's showing blue to your right for some sensory tracks, and I like the fact that your book throughout uses blue for sensory stuff. And right off the bat, what I want you to do is sort of draw a line in the sand again, if you will. Draw a line, follow my pointer, draw the line right about there. I'm sort of kind of cutting the spinal cord in half. I know I'm fudging it a little bit, but I'm doing it for a reason. What kind of a colored tracks are mostly behind my line? Well, it's mostly blue, and that's a general principle in neuroanatomy. In general, in the brain and in the cord, sensory information is coming in the back. What's in the front mostly? We have red stuff, so it's mostly motor stuff. And again, big general principle point. In the central nervous system, in the brain, in the cord, Motor information is generally in the front. So write that down. Also, don't be confused by this picture. I know your book is showing the motor stuff off to your left and the sensory stuff off to your right, but that's just for demonstration purposes. Of course, we have both motor and sensory tracks on both sides of the cord, okay? I'm not going to pick on all the tracks. I'm not going to show you a picture on the test that you're going to have to pick them off, but I am going to ask you to know four of them. Let's pick just two motor tracks and two sensory tracks to know. We'll look at two motor tracks called the direct and indirect pathways, and we'll look at two sensory tracks called the spinothalamic tracks and the posterior columns. Let's break it down one at a time in that order, starting with the sensory tracks. Well, the spinothalamic tract, we already broke that down. Spino means spinal cord. It's heading up somewhere to some part you don't know yet. This has to be an ascending sensory tract just by the name. But what's the function? I want you to know what information is carried by our spinothalamic tracts. It includes pain and temperature. How do I remember that? Because I know there's lots to remember in this course. For my pea brain, here's how I do it. I picture that pain and temperature are things that would send shivers up my spine. So when I think of shivers up my spine from pain and temperature, I think spinothalamic tract. And my further visual is I take a hot poker, a red hot poker, and I poke myself, and that would send shivers up my spine, so that would have to go up the spinothalamic tracts. As opposed to the only other sensory tract I want you to know, called the posterior columns. Here they are in blue, and you're saying, wait a minute, the name doesn't really tell me, it says posterior, so I guess they're in the back, but how do I figure the rest of it out? You figure it out by remembering the big general principle in neuroanatomy. Sensory in the back, motor out the front. So the posterior columns must be sensory tracts. And they are. What kind of information is carried up the posterior columns? Here we go with a big word. Proprioception. Very important to know. We'll mention it several times during the course. Also, touch and vibration. So you know what touch is, you know what vibration is, but what in the world is proprioception? I'm going to give you sort of a P tongue twister to kind of remember this. Proprioception is the ability to perceive the position of our parts in space. Okay, what does that mean? Well, in class, I usually give a visual. I show a little dance move where I swing my arm around above my head. And you know, even with your eyes closed, you know the position and movement of your joints and your parts. Even with your eyes closed, you know that. And that ability to sense, to perceive the position and movement of your parts in space, that's called proprioception. Okay, so now some of you are saying, I can remember those two tracks, but so what? Who cares? Well, what are the clinical implications? You go to the doctor. Let's say you're the doctor. I come to you and say, Doc, my leg, it's numb. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to use your knowledge. You're going to get out your black bag, and you're going to take out maybe a needle. And you're going to maybe you heat up the needle. Now, don't really do this. I'm just using this for memorization technique. So you take your lighter, you know, from your concerts, and you heat up your needle red hot, and then you poke me with it in my leg. And I say, Doc, I can't even feel that. And you say, oh, well, I know that. That's supposed to send shivers up your spine. Maybe you've got a problem with your spinothalamic tracts. Maybe we should do an MRI of your spinal cord with attention to the spinothalamic tracts. Or maybe you poke me with that hot needle and I say, man, that really hurt. What are you doing, doctor? And then you say, okay, don't worry. I got it now. Then you reach in your bag and you pull out the tuning fork. Why are you pulling out the tuning fork? To make an extra $20 on the consult? Well, maybe. No, I'm only kidding. Okay, you pull out the tuning fork, you bang it on the table, you get it vibrating, you stick it on my leg, and I say, nope, I can't feel that vibration. And you say, aha, you must have a problem, potentially, with your posterior columns. I will tell the radiologist to get an MRI scan of your spinal cord with special attention towards the posterior columns. That's why you're learning this stuff, to help people, not just to get an A. Couple of motor tracks to look at. The first motor tracks are the direct pathways. Notice the direct pathways. Circle it, highlight it, star it, whatever you want to do. All start with the word cortico. Remember your root word, cortex, means bark. And here, in these terms, cortex refers to the outer bark of your brain. And you can't get any higher up than that. So, all these tracks start at the top and they go down somewhere lower. They must be a motor tract if they start with the word cortico, and they must be direct tracks because they're coming directly from the top of your brain. What do they control? It's easy for me to remember. Direct pathways control direct, precise, voluntary movements. In other words, I go to pick up a pencil off the table, that's a direct, precise, voluntary movement under control of the direct pathways. As opposed to the only other motor track I want you to know, the indirect pathways. Look at the names of a couple of them off to the right there. But more importantly, what's their purpose? Well, they control things that are not directly under my control. Example, automatic movements, posture, muscle tone, balance, coordination. These things are not directly under your control. They're under indirect control. They're sort of on automatic, aren't they? I mean, as you're sitting there maybe in your chair, you're not thinking, you know, flex this muscle, you know, contract that one, relax this one. It's just all under cruise control. Those are the indirect pathways. Now we get to move out of the spinal cord and take a look at the spinal nerves. So let's go ahead and break into that. There are 31 pairs of spinal nerves. They're matching right and left pairs. Most of them shoot kind of straight out from the sides, out of the spinal cord, like we talked about and I gave you a visual of earlier. Thank goodness we don't have to know all 31 of them. I'm just going to ask you to know a few of them later on in this unit. You do have to know how they're grouped, though. And the good news is the groupings basically match the number of bony vertebrae you learned in A&P1. For example, you probably remember there were 7 cervical vertebrae, but there are 8 pairs of cervical spinal nerves. Why? Because the first pair comes out above the first cervical vertebrae. There are 12 pairs of thoracic spinal nerves, and there are 12 thoracic vertebrae. There are 5 pairs of lumbar spinal nerves, and there are 5 lumbar vertebrae. There are 5 pairs of sacral spinal nerves, and if you remember, the sacrum is usually, or is, 5 fused vertebrae. And finally, we only have 1 coccyx, and there's only 1 pair of coccygeal spinal nerves. So that's the general breakdown. This is a great picture. A lot of anatomy, a lot of function on this slide. and maybe lots of test questions. Here is our old friend, right? A spinal segment. It's a piece of spinal cord with one attached pair of spinal nerves. Let's go ahead and break this down further and talk about its function. First of all, these spinal nerves, they're not just dangling off the cord, they're attached to the spinal cord. Two bundles of axons called roots connect each spinal nerve to a spinal segment. So, for example, here's a spinal nerve, and here are the roots that root it into the spinal cord. Here is a back root, kind of with some blue color here. The back root, some genius called the posterior root or the dorsal root. And more importantly, those carry the incoming sensory information through those axons. Remember, sensory in the back. Along that back root is a lump, a swelling called a ganglion. It's called the dorsal root ganglion, which just means the back root swelling. Why is it swollen on the back root? Well, you'll see it in lab. What's inside of there are neuron cell bodies, sensory neuron cell bodies stuff that lump and make it into a lump. That brings me to sort of a general term in anatomy and a little fun story while you're making notes. Ganglion just means a lump or a swelling. And when I was a little kid, even my grandma knew that. And you'll see it in your patients. I had a lump in my wrist when I was 5 years old, and I showed it to my grandmother, and she says, "Well, you have a ganglion cyst, and I know the treatment." You know what she told me? She says, "You go slam that with a book and pop it open." So, at that time, the biggest book in the house was the Bible. So I took the Bible. I went outside where no one would hear me scream. And I took that book and I slammed it down while my hand was on the pavement. And I squashed that cyst open. Now, please, again, don't do anything I say to do. Just learn the stuff. That's just a story. And it's really not the treatment for a ganglion cyst. But you'll see. Next piece on this diagram is the root of axons in the front called the anterior or ventral root. Remember, they contain outgoing motor neuron axons. Motor out the front. Then where those two roots join together, they form the spinal nerve, which is called a mixed nerve with a star. Why? Mixed means it has mixed function, both sensory and motor function. And that spinal nerve will eventually get out of our bony spinal column through some holes I'll show you on the next slide called the intervertebral foramen. But let's stop right here and talk about clinical significance and how I can ask you questions to see how well you understand this. Here we go. On the test, I take a pair of scissors and I cut several of the dorsal roots right here. What problem will your patient have? Loss of sensory function, loss of motor function, or both? And the answer is loss of sensory function. On the test, your patient has a gunshot wound, and the gunshot damages an anterior root. What problems will your patient have? Loss of sensory function, loss of motor function, or both? And the answer is, since we cut the front root or damage the front root, it's loss of motor function. Next on the test, I put an ice pick and I slice through a spinal nerve. What problems will your patient have? Loss of sensory function, loss of motor function, or both? Correct answer, of course, is both, because this is a mixed nerve. Don't miss it on the test. This is a picture I took from the bone chapter. And it's kind of beautiful because here's your bony vertebrae, and then here's the spinal nerve, because we got to get that spinal nerve to where it's going. And it has to get out through a hole. And I love the name of the hole. It's called the in-between the bone hole, called the intervertebral foramen. So that's a beautiful picture of the spinal nerve exiting the bony column and heading out to places we'll talk about in the next part of this discussion. This is a gross anatomy slide from your book. Nothing new here. I just love this picture. It shows an anterior view of the spinal cord. You can see the pia mater with blood vessels. You can see the gray butterfly, the central canal. It's so pretty. You can see denticulate ligaments like suspension wires holding that cord in position. You can see some roots, some nerve roots, and a spinal nerve actually going out of the intervertebral foramen. So what a gorgeous picture and a review of some of the stuff you learned. And I just, again, I love looking at the real deal. I hope you enjoy these too. What we're going to do next is something you did or going to do in histology in the lab, so I won't spend a lot of time. You have to know the connective tissue coverings of the spinal nerves. So look, here's a spinal nerve, just came out of the bony column. We're going to cut it, cross-section it with a pair of scissors. What does it look like? First of all, what is this thing called a nerve, a spinal nerve? A nerve is not a nerve cell. Remember, a nerve cell is a nerve cell. A cell is a cell with a nucleus, organelles, cell body, etc., etc. A nerve is a group of hundreds to thousands of axons. These are the high tension, electrical copper wires carrying electricity to wherever they're going. So a nerve is a group of thousands of axons. That's what a nerve is. And here's the setup. The outermost connective tissue covering on top of the entire nerve is called the epineurium. The root words mean on top of the nerve, just like in muscle physiology. And if you remember muscle anatomy and physiology, these terms are the same. Remember the epimysium, if you check back at your notes? So here we have epineurium. Then, in this cross-section, notice that we have bundles of axons within the nerve. And the root word for a bundle in neuroanatomy, just like in muscle anatomy, is a fascicle. So here are fascicles, bundles of axons. Each bundle has its own individual connective tissue wrapping that goes around it, called the perineurium. And then finally, shown in this picture from your book, they kind of pull out, suck out one axon, and each axon around it has its own individual kind of saran wrap, wrapping, or insulation going around it called the endoneurium. Endo means the innermost. So that's the innermost wrapping of each individual axon. I love this picture. This picture is off the chain. I love these scanning electron micrographs, gives you a 3D kind of a feel, almost 1,000 power. And I want to do a little review here and a little quiz here, because this is such a great slide. Here we have a cross section through a nerve. Here we have some fascicles. There's a bundle, there's a bundle, there's a bundle. Remember, around each fascicle is the connective tissue covering called perineurium. Over here, we see an axon. There's an axon, there's an axon. And the connective tissue covering around that is the endoneurium. Now, two great questions. Sometime I've asked this. Number one, where is the myelin? Remember, most axons in the human body are myelinated. Where is the myelin? I will point as best I can on this picture. The myelin would be right here, just underneath the endoneurium and on top of the outside of the axon. Remember, myelin's like a donut of fat that insulates and speeds conduction along that axon. So that's where it is. One little memorization technique I give on that, usually on the board at this point in time, for the axon, I draw a red hot wire. I draw a red, big red dot. Then I leave a white space around the red dot to represent the white donut of fat called myelin. Then I draw usually like a dark purple or black circle outside of that. And that's meant to represent the endoneurium connective tissue covering. And I ask people to look at that, and I say, what does that look like when I just draw, and it's supposed to look like a bullseye? And I say, what do you do with a bullseye or a target? You aim at the target. This will help you in lab, by the way. And that's my mnemonic for remembering the order of things. Aim. A is for axon. That's the bullseye in the middle. M is for the white donut of fat called the myelin, and E is for the outer connective tissue wrapping called the endoneurium. So A-M-E is the order. I know that's really not how you spell aim, but it works in this situation. Then comes an even more complicated question. It tells me, do you really know what's going on here? Do you really understand the anatomy? So where is the cell membrane of the axon? Ah, that's a tough one. But think back to the anatomy of a neuron. A neuron is a nerve cell. It's a very funky shaped cell. Remember, with dendrites and axons and all some other junk. A cell is a cell. It is surrounded by the outer limits called the cell membrane. So where is the cell membrane of the axon? You could figure it out by just realizing the axon is part of the cell called the neuron. So the cell membrane of the axon is plastered, of course, right on the axon. So I have another mnemonic to help you. So the full mnemonic is actually ACME, A-C-M-E. In this picture, it would go A for axon, C for cell membrane of axon, M for myelin, and E for endoneurium. So maybe you drew your own picture a little bit bigger, but a great mnemonic. And I've asked the question, you know, your patient gets a knife wound, what layers does it slice through in order? And you should be able to figure it out using that mnemonic.